My name is Jennifer Bing, and I work at the American Friends Service Committee. And I want to tell a story about when Kathy Kelly and Anne Wright and the Freedom Flotilla got in touch with the American Friends Service Committee was about at the end of March, early April. And we were just ending a month-long speaking tour with Ahmed Abu Artema from Gaza. And Jihad was on that tour with him, going to cities from coast to coast. We had been working on that tour and with Ahmed for 3 months, and we get this email saying, hey, would you like to work on a flotilla in July in the Chicago River? And we are like, what are you even? We can't possibly do that. But here we are. Yay. Tomorrow we're going to be having a protest that goes from the Israeli consulate to Boeing. And thanks to my sister, hello Rebecca, who's here with the good teacher handwriting who made these posters for us today. And I think as much as we all know facts about Boeing being their international headquarters right here on the Chicago River, I have to say that when I started to investigate what their role was in connection to the military assaults and on Gaza and in general with their connection with the Israeli army, I was surprised by some of the materials that we found. So another thing that in that research, I realized that there were 15 universities around the United States where student assemblies passed divestment resolutions saying they wanted to divest from Boeing that passed. That isn't just the many that were tried, but 15 that named Boeing, including, yay, Chicago. We have Northwestern University students, University of Illinois at Chicago, University of Chicago, and DePaul, all who are here. So of those 15, the other thing that if you know me and if you follow my social media, or you know that Gaza is always very much on my mind and something I care deeply about, the people there, and the American Friends Service Committee has staff in Gaza, so we communicate with them regularly and have this long history since 1948 being there. In preparation for tomorrow, I decided that, you know, I would look for just the names of Palestinians killed 5 years ago in the month of July. And I have 30 pages of names. Wow. 30 pages of names, 1,254 Palestinians killed in 1 month. So if that's not motivation for you to join us tomorrow and Saturday, or to write a postcard to your member of Congress, and we have cards over here, or to your friends, or to whomever, to spread the word that Gaza needs to be free, that we need to end the blockade, and somebody needs to be held account for these 1,254 lives. But let's get on with the program, because we too have two amazing speakers here tonight. And the first person I'm going to introduce who will speak first is Jihad Abu Salim. And I am so lucky to be his colleague at the American Friends Service Committee. He came to us a little over a year ago. Originally, Jihad is from Gaza, Palestine, where he lived most of his life, and where he earned his degree in business administration. I had to laugh when I saw that. I'm like, well, at Al-Azhar University, and also in Hebrew language from Islamic University. And he came in 2013 to attend a PhD program at New York University, and he is now an activist with AFSC, but also still working on his dissertation. at the Hebrew and Judaic Studies and History Joint Program at New York University. And his research is super fascinating, which is about the Palestinian intellectual writings about Zionism in the first half of the 20th century. And he always comes and tells me these interesting little tidbits that he found from all sources, and it's amazing. He's a lover of history, and I find does an amazing job of talking about history in a way that's incredibly engaging. When he lived in Gaza, he also volunteered with a lot of youth groups and worked on initiatives with social society organizations around women's empowerment, popular education. He worked on some Palestinian national reconciliation projects, and all of that prepared him so well to come to the United States and to engage in the advocacy work that we're doing around Gaza. I've sat in meetings with him when he's spoken to members of Congress. I've watched him testify on Capitol Hill about Gaza, and you know, every time I just I'm so in admiration. And he has been published widely in Al Jazeera, English 972 magazine, Vox.com, Palestine Square, and other places. You may have seen him on Democracy Now. And as I said in earlier, he accompanied Ahmed Abu Ortema on this month-long tour across the country talking about Gaza. But I wanted to quote something from him that he wrote about a year ago in Palestine Square. He was talking about, he wrote about the kind of ongoing humanitarian crisis and what exists, the collapsing health sector, high unemployment rates, high poverty rates, overcrowded schools, polluted water, very little access to electricity. And Jihad talked about this reality thus. This debilitating reality was not an option Palestinian refugees willingly chose. All they wanted to do was to return to their homes. What they were not expecting was that their exodus would be prolonged for 7 decades. And that they would be subjected to condescending efforts to avoid their right to return. Many attempts were made by regional and international actors to resettle the refugees either inside or outside Gaza. Palestinians resisted such attempts and emphasized that their desire to return to their homeland is not a product of irrational rejection of any peaceful settlement on their part, but rather a commitment of a people who are strongly tied to their land and heritage and refuse to live in a world where state boundaries and demographic realities are dictated through the barrel of a gun. So that's just a Jihad. Then we have with us, luckily today, because her flight was canceled earlier today, and we're like, oh no, we're going to have to bring in and by Skype, thank you, weather gods, she's here. Anne Wright attended the University of Arkansas, where she received her master's and law degree. So again, we have PhD and law degrees, all this stuff. In National Security Affairs from the U.S. Naval War College. After college, she spent 13 years in the U.S. Army and 16 additional years in the Army Reserves, retiring as a colonel. She is airborne qualified. In 1987, Colonel Anne Wright joined the Foreign Service and served as U.S. Deputy Ambassador in Sierra Leone, Micronesia, Afghanistan, and Mongolia. She received the State Department's Award for Heroism for her actions during the evacuation of 2,500 people from the civil war in Sierra Leone, at the time the largest evacuation since Saigon. She was on the first State Department team to go to Afghanistan and help reopen the embassy there in December 2001. On March 19, 2003, the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq the second time, Ann Wright cabled a letter of resignation to Secretary of State Colin Powell, stating that without the authorization of the UN Security Council, the invasion and occupation of a Muslim Arab oil-rich country would be a violation of international law. She was only one of only three persons who resigned from the U.S. government in opposition to the Iraq War. Since then, Anne has been writing and speaking out for peace. She fasted for a month, picketed at the U.S. prison at Guantanamo, Cuba, served as a juror in Bush mock impeachment hearings, traveled to Iran as a citizen diplomat, and has been arrested numerous times for peaceful, nonviolent protest of Bush's policies, particularly the war on Iraq. She has also been on delegations to Iran. As relevant to tonight's conversation, Anne has traveled to Gaza three times in 2009 following the Israeli attack on Gaza that killed 1,440 Palestinians and wounded 5,000. She also visited Gaza in 2011 and 2012 and was an organizer of the 2009 Gaza Freedom March that brought 1,350 people from 44 countries to Cairo, Egypt, in solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. She was on the May 2010 Gaza flotilla that was attacked by the Israeli military and was an organizer of the 2011 U.S. boat to Gaza, the Audacity of Hope, and a boat leader on the 2015 Gaza Freedom Flotilla. Within days following the Israeli attack on Gaza in 2012, she helped organize a delegation to Gaza. In 2013, she was a delegate on the 100 Women Group to Gaza for International Women's Day, which was stopped by the Egyptian government. She was a boat leader on the 2015 Gaza Freedom Flotilla and also on the Zaytuna, the women's boat to Gaza, in 2016. Anne has traveled to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen to talk with families whose family members have been killed by U.S. assassin drones. She has been arrested in New York and Nevada at U.S. drone bases for protesting U.S. killer drones. She has traveled all over the world, including to the Koreas, Japan, El Salvador, Chile, Nicaragua, and to Standing Rock in North Dakota, where she stood in solidarity with Native Americans attempting to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. What an amazing person. Thank you. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to Jihad, and then we'll follow with Anne. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Jennifer, for the very generous introduction. Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Thank you all for being here tonight. It's an honor to be here with you, and it's so good to be back in Chicago. Chicago is home. Is home in America for me, and I moved to Chicago in fall of 2017, and then this summer my wife and I moved to Boston, so it's good to be back in the summer, of course. And today, as I took the train from the suburbs to come here, and I spent the day in the office, you know, thinking about this moment, you know, when I will stand and speak and talk about Gaza, and the title of the event tonight, Why Gaza Matters to Us. I didn't have really clear ideas about what I'm going to talk about. And as I was starting to think about what is it that I will talk about? Talk about the siege, the numbers, the statistics, the unemployed, the poor, those who live under poverty line, those who are unable to travel, those who are unable to go home. How many years have passed since this blockade have been imposed on Gaza? My colleague Jennifer handed me this list, which she talked about earlier, of the 1,254 people who were killed during the month of July. And I realized a few things as I was looking at the list. The first thing, the first realization was that neither me myself, nor my family in Gaza, nor my friends, nor the people I follow on social media have been able to talk yet about the 2014 war. And in fact, in the collective conversation on social media, just last year, I noticed that people in Gaza just started to talk about what happened in 2008-2009, the so-called Castled Operation. And I thought to myself, wow, it really does take a lot of time to begin to process such a heavy burden that is passed on us. I looked at this list, and the first name that I saw on the list, Suleiman Baraka, 31 years old. Once I saw this name, I started to shake, and I've been holding my tears all day in the office. And the reason why is that this is someone who comes from the same town that I come from. This is someone who is 1 year older than me. This is someone who I saw walking down the street, going to the mosque, going to the store, talking to people. He worked in the mayor's office. He was, you know, someone who was, he would smile in your face, no matter he knew you or not. He would greet you gracefully and be nice to you. But on July 31st, 2014, this guy's life was ended. He was walking down the street, and a missile landed near him and killed him. He was an engineer. I didn't know him well. I wouldn't say that I was close friends with him, but I knew he was. And just looking at the list, at a name next to a number, that had a huge effect on me. And then looking at a list of 1,254 people, each one of them had a story. Each one of them had friends. Each one of them had family. Each one of them had a dream. Maybe simple dreams. Just wanting to, you know, make a living, stay home, watch TV, do the things that people here do. And maybe others had bigger dreams. Reach for the stars. The 5-year-old and the 6-year-old and the 7-year-old. Those who were looking at the sky and thinking about becoming astronauts one day, or pilots, or thinking about superheroes. But then the sky would become a metaphor for death for them. And they won't even get a chance to think about that, because what comes from the sky ended their lives. So in tomorrow's protest, those names will be read, 1,254 names. And then I flipped through the pages. And another thing that was one of the really hard details about the 2014 war. An entire family, father, mother, and five children, all wiped out from the civil registry. Gone. So, 2014 is still yet to be talked about. 2014 is still yet to be processed in the hearts and minds of the people in Gaza. And this is why Gaza matters to us. It does matter because it is a place that does not simply surrender. And this isn't just a cliche talk. The refusal to surrender and to give up and to stay strong in the face of challenges and whatnot. No. People in Gaza are humans like us, you know. Amongst them there is the weak and there is the strong and there is those who are willing to sacrifice and those who are willing to those who hate that they have to be in that position. Those who want to leave and those who want to stay, those who want to be heroes and those who don't, those who want to be martyrs and those who just wait for the minute that they can lead a normal life like the rest of us. But when I talk about Gaza's refusal to surrender, I talk about this collective spirit of the people there. That despite this, before I get to this point, my grandmother, from my mother's side, she witnessed 1948. We're not refugees. We're from a small town in the middle of the Gaza Strip. But she was there to witness the arrival of refugees as people were being kicked out from the rest of Palestine. She lived through the 1956 war, the occupation of Gaza in 1956. She lived through the 1967 conquest of Gaza, the West Bank, the Sinai, and the Golan Heights. 1973, then she moved to Lebanon. She lived through the 1978 invasion of the South, 1982 invasion when she lost her husband. She moved back to Palestine. She lived through the First Intifada, the Oslo process, the Second Intifada, caste-led, the 2012, I don't know what they call this one. Pillar of cloud?
Pillar of defense.
Pillar of defense. Yeah. Creative. But for her, 2014 was different. In terms of the scale of the bombardment, in terms of the violence, and in terms of how long that aggression continued for. 53 days of non-stop bombardment of a very tiny area. Gaza is very small. So, surviving that, 53 days, the people in Gaza continue to live under blockade afterwards, go back to the same conditions that were a major cause of why there was violence in the first place, that an entire population, 2.2 million people, would live and die and suffer under horrible conditions of no water, no electricity, no access to the outside world, no dignity, under blockade, punished by siege, a medieval method, closed off from the rest of the world, dehumanized on the media, smeared all the time just for their existence. That's why Gaza matters. Gaza does matter because people there say no. Whether they say it loudly or whether they say it by just, you know, moving on with their lives despite these conditions. And no one knows what is it that the Israelis want from Gaza. The recipe for resolving the situation is unclear. If you go to if you examine the thinking of Israeli policymakers, they know that the people of Gaza, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, won't surrender. They know that the military factions, the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip, won't surrender their weapons, because then they will be committing political suicide from their perspective, from their point of view. And they know that they can't kill everybody there, because, you know, of their image issues, whatever. So, but they continue to impose this blockade on Gaza, maintaining the status quo, trying to do with the blockade what they can't do in a direct military operation, trying to break the souls of the people there, deprive them of their humanity, turn them into monsters, pit them against each other, increase the rates of domestic violence and divorce, give them 4 hours of electricity a day, few resources in a very small area with a lot of people. It's a social experiment coming from a very nasty place. If you think about people sitting in rooms with pens and papers and computers thinking about how to control this population, how to deal with it, and how to think of policies to perpetuate the situation, and how to survive the implications legally, how to calculate the calories of how much food we send so that we don't have a humanitarian crisis that would invite international intervention or attention, but at the same time, keep their heads a little bit above the water so that they don't die. But yet, Gaza still says no. And Gaza still says no to the delusional frameworks imposed by the international community. The international community, bless you, the international community and Israel and others refuse to take Gaza seriously, refuse to address the major questions around Gaza, because basically Gaza is a place where all these ideas about a two-state solution and economic peace and resolving the refugee question without return, all these questions simply become small and irrelevant when it comes to Gaza. Because first of all, how are you going to create a two-state solution while keeping Gaza in the same area, the same geographic area? How are the people there going to have natural population growth? What's going to happen to the 70% of the population there that are refugees? What's going to happen to this region that has zero resources and a lot of people who are dependent on international aid? What will the borders of that region look like? No one wants to answer these questions, because these are the big questions that destroy the foundations of the frameworks imposed by the international community. So what happens? What happens is that we end up with perpetual warfare against the people in the Gaza Strip. What happens is continuous fragmentation of the Palestinian people, dividing the West Bank from Gaza, Gaza from the Palestinian diaspora, outside the boundaries of historic Palestine. isolating Palestinians and confining them in bantustans. And Gaza is the largest bantustan. And what we will witness in the years to come in the West Bank is a Gaza model that will be applied to the remaining Palestinian population pockets in the West Bank, surrounded by walls and gates shortly after the current economic bubble of the PA collapses or diminishes or weakens, because its survival is conditioned on the generosity of the international community. Thus, scattered Palestinian bantustans, communities in the West Bank that are surrounded by walls and gates. And they are actually suffering Gaza's fate, and what's happening in Gaza will be applied there. Total isolation. And if anybody rejects the imposed formulas, the imposed recipes from the international community, they will meet the same fate. Gaza matters because since 1948, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, like Palestinians elsewhere, said no to solutions, to frameworks that deny Palestinians' connections to their land, deny Palestinian right of return, deny Palestinian humanity, and render the Palestinian cause as a humanitarian issue, and render Palestinians charity cases. In the 1950s, Palestinians in Gaza protested refugee resettlement plans when the international community tried to resettle Palestinians in the Sinai. After 1967 occupation, Palestinians resisted that occupation, and throughout the 70s and the 80s, they said no to all projects that aimed at undermining our national cause. And in the 1987, Gaza was the birthplace of the first intifada, the first uprising. And Gaza still continues to uphold its duty, its part of our struggle against colonialism and occupation. To end, I'm sure this question will be raised in the Q&A. And this question will come in the form of, what is it that we do to help Palestinians in Gaza? And while the answers can vary and one can have many answers, I would say that, like Gaza suffers from perpetual warfare, perpetual isolation, constant blockade, our job needs to meet these challenges. We need to continue our work. We need to pay attention to Gaza, not only in the seasons of bombardment, or what the Israelis call mowing the lawn, but to continue our work between each and the next war, to continue our work when people in Gaza are not being bombed, but also when they're besieged, when they're being deprived of dignity, electricity, and food. Continue our work, because if we are unable to help the people in Gaza who are besieged and separated from their families in other parts of the world, if we abandon these people and we abandon them, and if we fail them, then how are we gonna help those who are being separated from their families here in America? How are we going to help those who are being deported? How are we gonna help those who have been suffering because of who they are, while Palestinians in Gaza have been dehumanized and smeared and isolated and killed just because of who they are? Thank you.
Well, Jihad laid it all out for us, didn't he? I mean, what do we do? What do we do when we see people around the world, and then particularly in Gaza, for decades that have been killed by the Israelis, that have been blockaded by the Israelis? And that's, I guess, why we're here. And I'm so glad that you all have come here tonight, and we want to thank Voices, and we want to thank AFSC and all of the groups here in Chicago that have taken on this challenge of how do we get our fellow citizens to know what's happening in Gaza? How do we get them to understand that this is going on, that all of the things that Jihad has said, and that every single Friday for the last year and months, the Palestinians have been going to the fence of Israel and Gaza and have been standing there to say, we're alive, we're here, and have been bombarded and have been shot and have been snipered and have had killings, 280 by now probably, I don't know the latest figure. Thousands, tens of thousands have been wounded and purposely shot through the knees, shot through, you know, places where there will be everlasting damage done to these young men and women. That medics have been specially targeted to kill the medics that are out there to help those that have been wounded. So we see what's going on, and as Jihad said, what do we do about it? What do we do about it? We have a government, and it doesn't matter what administration's in. The Republicans, the Democrats, they all seem to be sucking up to the state of Israel. This latest administration, probably the worst. But it's not just this one. I mean, all of them are part of that network of being co-opted by the supporters of the state of Israel. And our politicians are afraid to challenge it. And I know you all are, many of you all are working in the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions programs to highlight, again, another way that we highlight to our fellow citizens that we can boycott certain things that will put pressure on the state of Israel to let them know we do not like what they're doing. We oppose what they're doing. Well, another thing that we've tried is one of the things that we're here to talk about tonight, a crazy thing called a flotilla. How in the world would a flotilla challenge what Israel is doing? Well, as Jennifer mentioned, these boats trying to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza, the naval blockade, you know, Gaza's surrounded and there's blockades everywhere on land and sea and in the air. So in 2008, the Free Gaza movement had this idea, we'll send little boats and we'll try to break that naval blockade. And in 2008, they had five boats that actually got into Gaza. The first boats in over 40 years, international boats that got in. But then starting with the Casled in 2009, that's when the Israelis started stopping the boats. And in 2010, they murdered people on the Mavi Marmara. Nine people were murdered, executed style. And another person died later. 50 were wounded. People were beaten up on all of the six boats. Compared to what Palestinians suffer every single day in Gaza and the West Bank, it was a drop in the bucket. But it was international blood this time, and it got a lot of attention. And so that's the way we're working on these flotillas, that if we can get some international attention by sending these boats, then hopefully the attention will go to why we're doing this, that we are so distressed about what is going on in Gaza, and these boats provide the vehicle to get international attention for them. A lot of people say, well, that's crazy, you know, you're just wasting your money. Your boats are now stopped. But we do get some publicity, not here in the United States. I mean, you know the newspapers and how they handle things here, and it's very seldom do you have a real balanced view of what's going on Palestine. But in Europe and in the Middle East, we do get a lot of publicity on them. We get a lot of it. And so that's why we reached out as a part of the U.S. Boats to Gaza, as a part of an international coalition of 12 national campaigns and two international campaigns that form the Gaza Freedom Flotilla Coalition. We decided this summer, since we're kind of in between, we had a flotilla in 2018 that had four boats. Two of the boats all the boats started in Scandinavia, and in fact, all of the people that were a part of that, Kit, Keith, Barbara, Elizabeth, come on up here, and Kathy, you were a part of the 2011 flotilla, so come on up here. All the people that have been working so hard to bring attention to the flotillas or to what's going on in Gaza in 2008, yeah, let's. Hey. Some over here. Yeah. In 2018, we had four boats, all of them starting in Scandinavia. Two of them went on the Atlantic side of Europe, and two of them went down the canals and waterways of Europe through Belgium and France, and then down into the Mediterranean, stopping in how many places did they stop?
I think we had 12 ports.
12 ports.
I think it was 14.
Oh, 14.
14, there we go. Yeah, because
we lost track.
Yeah. Kit and Barbara and Keith were there for all of those ports. They traveled for over 75 days all over Europe to be the support for these boats as they came in and to organize things such as what we're doing here, organize people in with the solidarity groups in those ports come out and have an event to talk about what's happening in Palestine. So we're going to have a flotilla again in 2020. But in this bridge year of 2019, we wanted to make sure the people were still talking about what's going on in Gaza and using this flotilla concept of bringing people together. And we want to thank people here in the Chicago area. I mean, you all are the first ones to step up to the plate on this. When I emailed Kathy first and said, "Do you think we could have a flotilla in Chicago?" And there was this kind of like, "What?" But it didn't last long. It was like, sure, and started reaching out. And Jennifer and all the rest of you all jumped right into it. And we'll have the very first real boats in a flotilla this time. Kayaks, what all are they going to have, Kathy?
Well, we now have 17 kayaktivists, and so that's kind of a goose and the goslings. And then we have two electric boats, and we started by saying bring your own bathtub, but now we're a bit more serious. I got that from her. That we're more serious now because the waters are very congested, and so we're very serious about the kayaks being seasoned. The kayakers being very seasoned, and every other boat on that river is booked out for tomorrow, except the two that we managed to get. So much of the energy will also be from the bridges and along the shoreline, and I think if this word goes back to people in Gaza, maybe there will be some sense that the isolation is just a little bit less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you, Chicago.
Yes, Chicago. Yay! We can't wait to see the pictures that'll be taken, and the people in Gaza can't wait. I mean, before we do any of these internet, well, wait a minute, no, wait, no, don't go back. There's more. Come on back. Before we ever do these flotillas that actually sail boats as far as we can get to Gaza, we always ask people in Gaza. We have a lot of friends and organizations we've worked with over the years. And we always ask them, do you want us to do another flotilla, or would you like for us to take the money that we will raise for this and give it to your organizations? And every year they've come back to say, it gives us hope. It gives us hope because we track what you're doing. You know, with social media, these kids in Gaza, they are, as long as the electricity's on, then they're tracking exactly where the boats are, what's going on, how many people showed up at whatever port it was. They watch the videos. They give hope. And then a lot of times the kids, the teachers bring the kids out to the beach in Gaza City or in any other place along, and the kids are out there and the teachers are saying, look out there, those boats are out there. And we've had some beautiful, beautiful sand sculptures that have been made by the kids of Gaza saying, welcome, free Gaza, we're glad you're coming. So, you know, it gives them hope. It gives them hope that they are not being forgotten. Well, so we're doing one in Chicago now. And Kit, why don't you tell what happened in St. Louis, our very first one?
So St. Louis also stepped up and said, yeah, we'll do one. And one of our comrades contacted, it was a Palestinian heritage festival. So we asked if we could be a part of that and set up a table. And what a wonderful event it was. And it wasn't on the water, though. So we really, Keith and I went, and we had a blow-up pool. And we had little origami boats with Gaza on them. And kids filled the table and filled the pool with origami boats, and we had a little picture of Gaza there and St. Louis to Gaza, and boy, did they have fun. And it was the only kid event there, really, but they loved it, of course, with water. And so that was a really wonderful event, and it was nice to have that collaboration with friends in St. Louis and Palestinians and others who are supporters of Gaza and the Palestinian fight for freedom and justice. And so now we have several other events. We'll be going to, well, we have this wonderful Chicago event. And then next week we're going up to Madison, and Kathy actually is going to be speaking up there. And we have a San Francisco event. And we have one at the Veterans for Peace Conference in Spokane, Washington. And then we're working on one in the northern New York Hudson River Valley. And maybe Miami, maybe Washington, D.C., and we've got a couple others in the fire. So this is what we're doing in this interim year. And, of course, we're always accepting donations as we're giving our – each campaign comes up with an amount of money that they can donate for this Flotilla 2020. And so we have Malaysia, New Zealand –
Sweden,
Norway, France, Spain,
Italy.
12 campaigns. So everybody contributes, and so this is part of our working toward our level of donation. So feel free to donate. We have some great T-shirts. This is hot off the press because each of our flotillas has a mission, and this one is for the children of Gaza and the Israeli blockade. And then the back, yes, has all of our different flotillas that we've done since 2008. So thank you very much for hosting us. We really appreciate it.
Now, well, wait a minute. No, not now. Okay, so this shirt is historic. In fact, all of the shirts that we've been sending out are really very interesting shirts. In fact, Elizabeth, come on up and let's see the... The women's boat to Gaza, isn't this a beautiful one? This was designed by a young Palestinian fellow. And then this is the one we had in 2018 with our three sails for Gaza. And now we have another one. See how the change on the face of this? It's not a woman anymore, it's a child. And for the children of Gaza, and that's our theme for 2020, because as Jihad said, I mean, think about all of the kids that have been killed by U.S. complicity in what Israel is doing. All of these bombs that we're going to be protesting against at Boeing, going to the Israeli consulate, and, of course, to our own government that is a part of this whole thing. Barbara, what are you doing in San Francisco for the flotilla? Come on over.
We're gathering down at the waterfront at the Embarcadero, and you're all welcome to join us. It's August 3rd. And we'll be flyering there. We will have four women dressed in black with white faces, and their signs will say Free Gaza. So that will be the serious part that we hope will focus everybody. We'll be doing educational flyering, and then we're going to get on the Sausalito ferry and ride over to Sausalito with the boat full of Palestinian flags. When we're in Sausalito, we'll do the same action that we did in San Francisco. We will have ice cream, and then we will ride the boat back. So come to San Francisco. It's a beautiful place. August 3rd, we'd love to have you join us.
And so each community is figuring out whatever they want to do, whatever makes most sense to them. And while you all are sitting right here in Chicago, I'm sure that you're part of other communities, New Jersey. We've got all sorts of people from all over the country here. We would love to have you all join us in this, in a small thing if you want, or a big thing. The size really doesn't matter, because when we take the pictures of people around the United States that are concerned about the people in Gaza and the West Bank, it means a lot to them. And we have Elizabeth Murray, who is here. She is with Ground Zero, which is a peace organization, anti-nuke organization that's up in the state of Washington, and she was part of our flotilla in 2018.
Hi, yes, I'm with the Ground Zero Center, and prior to that, I was with the U.S. government intelligence for 27 years before I became a peace activist. And so I wanted to go back to something that Jihad mentioned in his talk, which is that the reference to mowing down people in Gaza and in Palestine, the Israelis like to call it mowing the lawn, as if Palestinians were just blades of grass to be cut down. And and when he mentioned that, it reminded me of back when I was in the government, and I went to a seminar on the Middle East at a prominent think tank in Washington, D.C. And it was someone was up there discussing I think it was the Operation Cast Lead in 2008. And he just kind of talked about the many casualties, and he looked a little bit sarcastic, and he looked at the audience, and he said, you know, it's unfortunate, but every once in a while, you gotta mow the lawn. And the audience reaction, and I have to say, in this audience in Washington, D.C., were some of the most prominent and esteemed Middle East experts, you could hear a tittering in the room, a delicate laughter. Ha, 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 you know, mowing the lawn, what a shame. People in Washington, D.C., as anyone who's worked there will tell you, they are so far away from the human aspect of the violence that this government, this country is perpetrating. And so, I mean, I have come to the point in my evolution as a peace activist, it's not going to come from our governments. If we want peace, if we want to draw attention to this issue, we've got to do it. And that is why the flotilla and all these events and all these initiatives and these wonderful speakers that are brought in are so important. Thank you.
Well, Elizabeth didn't quite mention all of her background, but she's got an even more extensive background with the U.S. government than I do. But she's on our side now. And I'd like to ask Keith Mayer, he has been with us as ground crew for the women's boat to Gaza in 2016 and the 75-day trip around Europe for 2018. And he has stories of talking to people all over Europe about the importance of this, and then what he and Kit have done in St. Louis, bringing these remarkable pictures that were painted by kids from Gaza.
Well, I just was thinking about what Jihad had said with regard to how long it takes for you to process something that has happened to you. And when we were in St. Louis, we had the little pool out, and we had the kids coming in and sailing the boats, and it was really touching. But we had the pictures out from Gaza, and a young boy came over. He was probably 13, and he specifically asked. He says, "Were these pictures painted by the children of Gaza?" And I said, "Yes." And he brought two of his friends over, and they were curious about it. And he was looking at the one picture in particular, and he's going, "Here's the helicopter. Here's our houses, here's what happened." And he was, you could tell he was going through that. And, you know, he was from Gaza and had lived through a lot of that. And you can just see not just the pain, but just the reality of what had happened to them. And so, you know, I was fortunate that I was able to go, like Anne had said, in Europe, and I was kind of the groupie. We schlepped the gear and met the boats, and I was fortunate that I could spend a lot of my time there and help. But it's a one-on-one thing. I mean, just telling one other person, wearing the shirt, having a button, and opening up a conversation and just sharing a little bit of information goes the farthest with regard to witnessing what's going on and letting people know that, you know, we're about peace and justice for all human beings and helping to make it personal for them. So thank you very much for being here.
So for the people of Gaza, we are here tonight. We are here to think of them, to think of the 1,200 names that we'll be saying tomorrow in front of Boeing and at the Israeli consulate. We're here because we're people of conscience, that we are willing to stand up to our own government's complicity in all of this. And we're willing to say to the people of Gaza, we are working to try to stop our government from doing this. So we thank you all so very much for being here. It's great to see such a great turnout tonight. It's a real credit to the activism here in Chicago. We've got lots of materials that are here. We've got lots of ideas. And we want to work with you in any way that we can to bring to our fellow citizens the outrage that's happening to the people of Gaza. Thank you.
Well, my name is Kathy Kelly. I work with Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and it's just a privilege to be with all of you here tonight. And Jihad, you brought home to us so clearly that war isn't over when it's over. And so the responsibility that is born over generations, and I was in a hospital in Gaza in 2009 toward the very, very end of that terrible operation Cast Lead. And I remember a doctor from the emergency room. He was an orthopedic surgeon. And it turned out he was from Lakeview, from Chicago. And I said, well, you know, what are you doing here? Likewise. And he talked about being almost ankle deep in the blood. And he talked about how they didn't have an ability to continue to do basic operations because the white phosphorus, when it was exposed, you know, if a person had white phosphorus subcutaneously, then when they were trying to remove it, it begins to burn again, and then they'd inhale it, and then they'd have to run away from the operating table. And he talked about dense, inert metal explosive weapons that just lacerate, cut off limbs, and there are no prostheses. And then he stopped, and he said, no, I am completely wrong. Just you go back to Chicago and tell people that it was United States funds that paid for these weapons that have been used against us these 22 days. And so that's a very, very hard message to bring. But when we go to Boeing, we know that they actually research and design and create and sell these small diameter bombs, which are what are used in order to fire the dense inert metal explosives. They've been making these JDAM kits that enabled chasing a father of a family walking down the street, the man who was 31 years old that Jihad remembers. So we have a role to go to Boeing, but also it's going to be our fervent hope that somehow, maybe somebody working inside that building will wonder, why are people wearing these masks? Why are they holding images of lifeless dolls, images of lifeless children? And we hope that people will sense that the solidarity that we present is something that would invite them to come in and to join us, even though as we ring a gong for each name that is named, we will be commemorating a life that should never, ever have been snuffed out. So we welcome you, please. We know it will be a scorcher tomorrow and the following day, but if you can come forth, we think there's good possibility to raise awareness here in Chicago. And Boeing will be preceded by going to the Israeli consulate, where we'll have a time of silence, and then there will be some remarks, and we'll be wearing the mourning mothers' costumes and passing out placards, and we'll have signage. And then anybody who can is oh so welcome to join us after we gather at Boeing at 12 noon up at St. Gertrude's Parish, which is located at Granville and Glenwood. And we do need to sort ourselves out a bit because it will be so hot for the flotilla. We want to have stations where we'll have Gatorade and water and people kind of at each station along the route, making sure that nobody will be overcome by heat exhaustion. And we'll certainly understand if you decide, you know, that's not the day for me to be outside. But for those of you who might be able to give it a try, we'd certainly welcome you to come. And Sarah Ball is back there in the back, a colleague and housemate at Voices. And Sarah has coordinated the kayaks, and she'll be doing great work getting that organized. We have already got the electric boats filled up, but there are plenty of other roles. So do stay around and talk to us afterward. Thank you so much, all of you, for coming forth. And thank you for having me.